Okay, meeting will come to order. Will the secretary read the roll?
Senator Weber.
Excused.
Senator Gillespie.
Here.
Senator Bartel.
Here.
Senator Boldman.
Excused.
Oh, she's here.
Senator Lenz.
Oh, she's here.
Senator Morgeau.
Here.
Senator McCamey.
Here.
Senator O'Brien.
Here.
Senator Salomon.
Here.
Senator Wellborn.
Here.
Senator Lang.
Okay, I'll follow Senator Small's lead in business and labor and tell everybody to shut their phones off. We don't want to hear them. And be sure and sign in if you're going to testify outside. And with that, Representative Casimir, I think you're ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. I represent Casimir, House 627. House Bill 388 today.
Could you grab the mic a little better?
It wasn't on. Sorry. Is that better? Okay.
It's better. Yeah.
Representative Casimir, House District 27, I bring before you House Bill 388. It's just increasing the penalty for transporting livestock through Montana without a health certificate. It's going to go up to $500 or $5,000, which whatever is greater. So with that, I'll listen to proponents, opponents, and take questions. Thank you.
Okay. First proponent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Honeycutt, H-O-N-E-Y-C-U-T-T, Executive Officer for the Montana Board of Livestock and Department of Livestock. I want to thank Representative Casimir for bringing this. This is actually an issue that the Board of Livestock had been discussing for quite some time, particularly with some of the animal health situations that we've dealt with in the last couple of years. So just to let you know, one of the things and the reason that we support this bill is that the current penalties we have, we don't feel serve as a adequate deterrent to folks who would want to bring animals in without the proper health testing and certification. If you look at the recent tuberculosis situation we dealt with, the state and federal government has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on that situation. Untold costs to livestock producers who had to deal with quarantines, and unfortunately in one case, a depopulation of a herd as a result of that. So we do want to keep these diseases from coming to Montana. We certainly don't want them to come to Montana because someone purposefully violated our animal health requirements. So the types of violations we see that would be covered by this penalty are folks who come into the state without any certificate of veterinary inspection or an import certificate. We do have cases where people misrepresent livestock to get around our testing requirements. The best example of that would be, for example, some rodeo stock that may be of Mexican origin or because of the way rodeo stock are handled have higher TB testing requirements than regular commercial cattle or particularly slaughter cattle. So occasionally we'll see people who will not have the proper testing in place. They will put on their import certificate that they're bringing in a load of commercial cattle when it's actually a load of cattle that should have had a TB test within 30 days of entry. And we just see people who flat out fail to meet our testing requirements. We see that a lot with horses, with Coggins testing for EIA. We have had EIA outbreaks in the state where we've had to ask owners to euthanize large numbers of horses. It's unfortunate if that situation occurs because a neighbor or someone brought in animals without following the proper regulations. And we do feel that a flat $500 fine is not an adequate deterrent for people to do that. Lastly, I just will give some statistics on, the question of does this happen in Montana? We looked back over the last biennium, and we have cited 141 illegal movements in the last 2 years for a total of about 3,300 animals that have entered the state illegally. And so we do want to make sure that becomes a much more rare occurrence and think that Representative Representative Kazmaier's solution here of an increased fine and sort of a stair-step fine based on how many animals you might be bringing into the state is a good solution, and why it was supported by the Montana Board of Livestock, or they chose to support his legislation. With that, I will be available for questions and urge a due pass on this legislation.
Yeah. Next up, you bet.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Cone, C-O-N-E, and I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation. We want to also offer our support for House Bill 388. This bill strengthens the penalties faced for bringing livestock into the state of Montana without a clear bill of health and without that proper health certification. The increase in fine ensures that the fines are serious enough for animals that are spreading diseases, especially if it's something that we have the ability to control. The increase in fines makes it so that it encourages people to actually follow the proper protocol. So with that, we would like to offer support and encourage a due pass. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are other proponents? Are there other proponents? Are there any proponents online? Oh, yeah, Rachel,
yes, Mr. Chair.
There we go.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Prevost, P-R-E-V-O-S-T. I represent Montana Farmers Union. We, MFU, stands in support of House Bill 388. This is a good bill for protecting herd health in the state of Montana. When cattle are imported or other livestock are imported into the state without that proper certification or inspection, puts other Montana producers and cattle herds at risk. Hopefully this increased penalty will deter future violations for those health inspection and certificate requirements. And we urge your support of House Bill 388. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Prevost. Are there any others online? No others online. Are there any opponents? Any opponents? Are there any other opponents online? Are there any informational witnesses either in the room or online? If not, are there questions from the committee? Maybe I'll go ahead and start. Mr. Honeycutt.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Honeycutt. Yeah, I guess I was kind of not really impressed by the numbers, but shocked a little bit. But you quoted 141 illegal moves within the state. And I guess that would just be the ones that you caught up with. I suppose there's more than that you didn't catch up with, would be my guess.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. We have limited resources. As some of you might know, how we catch people doing this, if we don't happen to catch them in the act, is we do occasionally what we call livestock check stations, where we ask livestock haulers to pull over and check for appropriate documentation, whether that's brand inspections, health paperwork, whatever they need to be moving livestock in the state. And that's where we largely find these. So, for example, some of these violations come out of a livestock check station we did on I-15 to the north of Menida Pass, where they're coming in from Idaho. That's the example of where we largely catch these, and with the limited amount of investigators we have across the state. So certainly if we've caught 141, we do certainly recognize there are other illegal movements that we did not catch because it's just impossible to stop, and we don't want to stop every livestock hauler that's moving across the state of Montana.
Yeah. Maybe a follow-up, if you would, and that would be... I guess I could see, are we going to have some sort of, assume this passes, then are we going to have some sort of maybe warning, get the word out? How could that part of it work, maybe to shock people into compliance, if you will, but at least beware so that it don't take 2 years of coffee room gossip, I guess, to get their attention.
Mr. Chair, certainly we will do stakeholder outreach and probably some media outreach upon passage of the bill, should that occur, to make sure people know that. And as far as you're talking about a warning, I should make sure folks understand this falls into a misdemeanor class of offense. It does give our enforcement officers, for people who are trying to be honest or honestly did not know about the regulations, to, as some would say, to educate before we regulate, to write them a warning ticket, same as you might get a warning ticket for a speeding violation. Certainly what we typically do in these situations is people have two choices when they get caught doing this, regardless of whether they get cited, which is to continue to their destination and be quarantined for testing until that occurs. Or in the case like where we had the livestock check station and we were doing that south of Dillon, we gave them an opportunity to turn their truck around and go back to Idaho if they wished to, and they did in many cases. So we do have some discretion not to be too rigid with folks who are making an honest mistake, but certainly for those folks who we know the intent or repeat offenders, we want to make sure we have an appropriate penalty for that violation.
Okay, thank you. See, I think Senator Wellborn first.
Thank you for Mr. Honeycutt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Honeycutt, just educate me a little bit. I understand, how does disease surveillance differ from like brand inspections crossing state lines? Is there an end run around these health inspections if they trail into Montana versus if they're hauled in on a truck, or is it one and the same as far as disease control?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wellborn, very good question. Different than brand inspections in that in many cases you can trail across a political boundary, whether it's a county line or a state line, without a brand inspection. If you are bringing animals into the state to reside in the state, you are still subject to the animal health regulations. Now, there are provisions within federal law that we recognize. For example, I'm one producer probably in your district I'm very well aware of, that operates on both sides of the border. We do have an agreement with Idaho on a seasonal grazing permit that allows them to do that without too much, without having to get a health inspection every time, because they are operating on both sides of the border. And so we do have recognition of that. But on the animal health side, I guess just to bring some clarity to that, there's many cases where you might need a brand inspection and a health certificate. It's not an either-or situation, because our brand laws are about ownership and documenting movement versus whether or not we have verified the health of those animals. When animals leave Montana, they're subject to the import requirements of the state that they're destined for. This is about animals coming into Montana, and we have various import requirements for different species, and veterinarians are very aware, well aware of what you have to do when you have animals crossing state lines. You check the receiving state's import requirements and make sure that the certificate of veterinary inspection indicates that they have complied with all necessary testing for that age and class or species of livestock for whatever that state's requirements are.
Follow up.
Okay, so with that being said, is there any follow-up by your department, or is there any oversight that after the cattle are here that the number at the destination matches the number that was on the health inspection to come in to make sure that some of them may be riding on a truck and others get trailed in and ending up in the same geographic region?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wellborn, that's a good question. Again, that speaks to enforcement, which sometimes is very difficult with the resources we have. But that is when we're doing enforcement activities, that's one of the things we're checking for. So if you are bringing in a load of 5 cattle for a rodeo and you show up with 10, that's another piece of sort of enforcement we do, is try to show up at whether it's livestock shows, or rodeos or different events where we know we have cattle coming in from multiple locations, and sort of do some spot checking on that. Our brands staff is an extension of our animal health staff in that regard. And so those are the types of things that we're looking for. And that, as I said, occasionally that the cattle or, and we're talking cattle there, but in any species, that animal has been represented as what it is. So if it's being represented as commercial cattle when it's not, because commercial cattle might have a different import requirement, those are things that would be subject to being cited under this law.
Senator McCamey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I was just curious about any kind of financial accountability here. Do we need a fiscal note, or is that not necessary?
Mr. Chair, Senator McCamey, no, fiscal note's not necessary. We're talking about a fine that's being paid. Largely, these fines are not coming to the Department of Livestock. They're going to the general fund. That's how they are required. So charging a higher fine when we do fine does yield potentially a little bit of a net improvement in general fund because it would be more money coming to the general fund, but we did not have a fiscal note on that.
Okay. Just a little quick follow-up. It seemed that there might be a need for more FTE. That's why I even asked.
Mr. Chair, Senator McCamey, no, we did not look at additional FTE. If we were looking at trying to achieve a higher level of compliance or maybe a higher level of enforcement, we would have looked at that. But we're talking about currently making sure the penalty fits the violation as we have been enforcing it all along.
Understood. Thank you, Director. Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Any other questions? If not, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Vice Chair, committee members. This is a good bill trying to deter bad actors from importing diseases into our state. We got to protect our herds. So with that, I'd ask for it to pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And would you like to? Do you have a sponsor for this?
Mr. Chair, I'd
want us to figure it out.
Go ahead. Whoever wants to take it.
All right.
I think Senator Bartel, because he lives in the center of the state and is the second largest cow-calf county, would like to carry that. If not, I will.
Okay. I'll let you guys fight over it.
Flip a coin. Senator Bartel, put you down.
Sheep and cattle.
Okay, would you like to move on with your next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House Representative Kazmer, House District 27 again. This bill is just simply allowing the Board of Livestock to review applications on characters or symbols that are previously not recorded with the brands. Maybe we'll get some more brands out there with different characters. So with that, I will stand for questions.
Okay, are there any proponents? Ms. Cohn.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Rachel Cohn, CONE, with Montana Farm Bureau. We also rise in support of Senate Bill 767 and House Bill, sorry. We want to support this bill and just allow for the utilization of more brands. This bill will just establish the process for people to utilize more characters for their brands that may not have been used before and allow them to be recorded with the department. So with that, we would encourage you to pass this one as well. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. More proponents? Are there any other proponents? Is there any proponents online?
No, okay, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. How about informational witnesses? Any informational? Thought we had one. Mr. Bodner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jay Bodner, B-O-D-N-E-R. I'm the Brands Division Administrator for the Department of Livestock and here to answer any questions.
Okay, no other info witnesses? Questions from the committee, please. Questions? Yeah, Ms. McCamey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. A question for Mr. Bodner, please, Director Bodner.
Senator Gillespie and Senator McGamey.
Okay, this is intriguing to me. We're adding some new designs or something to the brands to make things available. Tell me a little bit more about that, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator McGamey. So this bill would allow for individuals to apply for a character that currently doesn't exist or an image that currently doesn't exist within our recordings of our brands. This application then would actually have, there's a process that it would actually go to the board. Most likely it would go to the brands. It'd be assigned to the brands advisory committee. They would then make a recommendation to the Board of Livestock, and then they would ultimately make that decision.
Okay, thank you. Another question, please. But
follow up, sure. Person.
Okay.
Senator McGamey.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGamey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good Representative Cashmire. I was just curious, what was the impetus for this? There has to be a reason why.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGamey, you know, I hear a lot of complaints back from my constituents. They can't get a two-iron brand, and there's a lot of conflicts. So we met over the interim with the Board of Livestock, and we were trying to find a way to make more brands available. So that's how this came about.
Yes, Senator O'Brien.
No, go ahead. I'll pass it.
Sorry.
Question for Director Bodner, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator O'Brien.
So it's a two-part question, Mr. Chair, if that's all right. I guess the first question is, how many brands are there? I think I heard it last year, or last session. And then secondly, how many brand characters, I guess, exist right now? Approximately. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator O'Brien, so we roughly have about 50,000 brands that are recorded. We recorded about 47,000 during re-record. We've since added some, and I think the last one I looked at is 49,800 and some. So we're probably a little over 50,000 at this point. Characters, I'd have to look to see specifically what we have or images that we have. There are quite numerous characters that we do have. I do have a copy of our policy that does list a number of the characters, and I could certainly leave that with you. That's as close as I can get at this point, but I could give you a more definitive number if you'd like. Yep, thank you.
Yeah, is there a follow-up, Senator O'Brien, or?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Are those online? Are those documents online?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator O'Brien, so what we do have available is if you look at each one of our, on our website, if you look under Find a Brand Recorder or Find a Brand, each one of the counties, each brand that's listed in each county is available online. So it's broke down there. So if you look through each county, you could see every available brand that's registered in Montana. But we don't necessarily have each character or image separated individually online.
Follow-ups?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the last question would be, of those 50,000, how many are spoken for? How many are being used?
Mr. Chairman, Senator O'Brien, so each one of those, as people register that brand, we do ask on new brands whether they own livestock or not. You know, there's no way for us necessarily to identify if a person owns five brands, if they put those five brands on animals or not. If we don't really have that capability to identify that at this point. Thank you.
Senator McGamey. Huh? Are there other questions? I might try one with Director Bogner, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
I guess, I know we've been in there before, and I was always amazed at how many brands there are that have been used at one time but are now not in use. Did most of those get used up in this last cycle, or are there still quite a few brands that aren't being recorded anymore, but there are brands there that you can just go down through the, I know we got one of them for each of our kids some 20 years ago, but does that still exist or?
So Mr. Chairman, a couple of things there. So the department, we did revise our brand policy almost 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. So we looked at, we have statewide character conflicts and then we have regional character conflicts. We did revise the regional character conflicts and we reduced a number of those. So that made more brands available. Secondly, let's see, I was trying to think where I was at now.
I guess on, yeah, how many brands that might be laying there just waiting for somebody to pick up.
Yes, certainly. So we used to post an inactive brand list. We do not do that anymore. And the reason behind that, Mr. Chairman, is because if we posted that today, we had 10 brands that came in for applications. That inactive list is basically outdated every day. So it gave a false sense that those brands would be available for people to apply for. And so we simply removed that list off our website.
Mr. Bodner, can you still go into the office and look at the brand book? That's what we did way back when, but that's still an option for somebody that wants a brand and can't get one they want. And so that's an easy option then.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so certainly everybody is welcome to come in the office. We don't necessarily have the brand book out available anymore. Most of those brands, like I mentioned, were online. So you can do kind of basically your own research to look at your county and any surrounding counties, because that's how we do our conflict checks, to see if you think that character might be available. And then at that point, you could certainly submit an application online or in person.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any more questions? If not, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yeah, this bill is just simply trying to get more characters available. So maybe you don't have to have a 3-iron brand. Maybe you can have a 2-iron brand, which is a lot easier putting on livestock, or maybe even a symbol could be a 1-iron brand. So with that, I'd ask for a due pass.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. We need I guess we could sit at ease for a little bit until we get have two more coming. We just need to get somebody, Representative Fitzgerald. I'll text him real quick here. Oh, yeah.
Whoever wants it.
Okay.
I'll take both.
Okay.
I'll remember.
Oh, all right. Okay.
You're going to have a busy day on the floor. There's a lot of cattle. Yeah. It's a subject you and I have been chatting about.
And then it is Fergus, is the subject. Cow county in town county, or in cattle numbers, because it's not just cow county, because it's registered cattle. It's,
we had one guy come in and bought up 44,000 acres, and we lost 3,300.
us a little something about Montpelier.
Mr. Chair, amongst all the hubbub and fol-de-rol over here and committee members, I'm pleased to be here. My name is Ross Fitzgerald, R-O-S-S-F-I-T-Z-G-E-R-A-L-D, House District 17, Teton, Pondere, and a chunk of Lewis and Clark County. I bring you here today, House Bill 418-418. And basically, as you see by the title, it's revising some limitations on irrigable acreage within an irrigation district. And all that is doing is snugging up the definition of irrigable acreage that's allocated to individuals and families. The purpose here today of 418 is to address MCA 85-7-1837 that are necessary to protect and strengthen the rules addressing acreage limitations as they pertain to government-based irrigation districts, as well as reinforcing the intent of the law developed. And I will let the details be described with the proponents and opponents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Proponents? Any proponents? There we go.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Erling Jewell, last name J-U-E-L. I am the district manager for Greenfields Irrigation District located in Fairfield. We have about 83,000 acres of assessed irrigable acres in our district. Our district covers Teton County, portions of Cascade County, and our infrastructure even extends into Lewis and Clark County. I'm here today in support of House Bill 418, and what this proposed bill does is provides language improvements to the existing law 85-7-1837, necessary to protect and strengthen the rules addressing acreage limitations as they pertain, as Ross said, to government-based irrigation districts, as well as reinforcing the intent of the law. Recent legal challenges have exposed weaknesses in the current law language, different from that which was originally proposed when this law was enacted. For the committee's benefit, acreage limitations restrict the number of assessed acres, those acres eligible to receive project water or GID water in my case, to an individual farm operation that can own and lease. For example, GID's limit is 960 acres of ownership. The acreage limitations originated from federal law applied to reclamation irrigation projects. The federally applied irrigation limits provided the farm ownership diversity and the concept of family farms for reclamation projects. That's what its intent was. And the goals and benefits of enforcing the acreage limitations are, to promote diversity of land ownership and family farms on land eligible to receive project water, also to provide the opportunity for increased number of independent individual family farms by making more land available at reasonably competitive prices, as well as making this land more available more often to young producers first starting out. It also is meant to avoid having the controlling interest of the district's governing board from eventually falling into the hands of land speculators or self-serving interests of a large producer, investment corporation, foreign interests, or even a small group of collaborating landowners or family members. And of course, before the district paid out its final financial obligations to the federal government, acreage limitations were federally mandated because of the above reference benefits. The acreage limitations provide assurances that the public benefits of a government-based irrigation district remain in place, protecting its sovereignty, as well as those public benefits to others outside of the district boundaries. When you look at the history of 85-7-1837, it originated because a bunch of irrigation districts got together in the 90s. They were fulfilling their financial obligation to the federal government and becoming independent. And as such, a lot of the requirements that they were required to operate under were sunsetting. And they recognized that the public benefits of irrigation limitations on their district were also going to be sunsetting. So they basically codified federal law to have that available for the irrigation districts. And that was their intent. And 85.7 in general recognizes the numerous public benefits of irrigation-based districts. As you know, Fairfield is a relatively small town, but it actually supports a very respectable Class B school. And that's not because of the town, but all of the small family farms making up the district, besides produce and cattle, our producers grow great families. And that's basically what makes Fairfield not a Class C co-op, but basically a standalone Class B school. And the irrigation district as a whole, the producers pay for everything. And that's the operation and maintenance of four dams and three reservoirs that the public benefits from: Gibson Dam, Willow Creek Dam, Pishkin Reservoir. All those benefits are available to the public, but our irrigators pay for them. So there's, and I could go on to all the numerous public benefits that a government-based irrigation district provides. But basically, eliminating the acreage limitations would actually defeat the purpose that they were intended for. And this law is meant to, correct some of the language weaknesses that it currently exists, and basically going back to the federal law and adopting some of the wording to eliminate any misconceptions that have been challenged. So in closing, I guess I would like to just say that I ask for your support passing 418, because I personally believe it's protects the family ownership, diversity, family farms, protects the governance and the sovereignty, and it protects the irrigation district in perpetuity against slowly being taken over if we didn't have a limit on how much ownership. Keep in mind that the more acres you own, the more votes you have in district business. So you could eventually become to the point where you could have a say in everything, take over the district, dissolve the district, and it's no longer a public benefit. So this basically is not creating a new law. It's not doing anything other than correcting existing law based on what was the intent back in the 90s. So again, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Other proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Murphy, representing the Montana Water Resources Association. And we stand in support of House Bill 418. As Mr. Jewell has indicated, the bill is simply providing for a clarification regarding the statutory intent that I believe was established in 1995. The intent was to provide for the sovereignty, the continued diversity, and the encouragement of family farm and ranch operations that are crucial to our rural communities throughout Montana. It reduces the potential of an irrigation district being controlled by one large controlling interest, particularly in the smaller districts that are scattered throughout Montana. House Bill 418 reinforces the intent of the original statute in regards to acreage limitations and a definition based upon a qualified recipient. And I think it's important to note, too, that as per the existing statute, the 960-acre limitation is a minimum, and that's by district, and that can be adjusted or changed and increased if that's the will of the district by the voters, the members of the irrigation district, landowners. So again, Mr. Chairman, with that, we stand in support of House Bill 418.
Okay, thank you. Other proponents? Are there other proponents? Do we have any online?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Prevo, P-R-E-V-O-S-T. I represent Montana Farmers Union. Montana Farmers Union stands in support of House Bill 418. Farmers Union members want to keep independent family farmers and ranchers on the farm, and they want their operations to continue to be sustainable for the next generation. And limiting the acreage that can be irrigated in a government-based irrigation district is a good step in the right direction. We oppose the consolidation of farmland ownership and control over our local irrigation district into the hands of the few. Having more farms in an irrigation district will help keep our rural schools open. As we know, these rural schools are often the heartbeat of our communities and essential for keeping the next generation in our small communities. So we urge you to support family farms and House Bill 418. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Prevo. Are there any others online? Don't think so.
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, are there any informational witness in the room? Oh, yeah. Guess we might try opponents, but there should be no. There will be an opponent, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name's Spencer Pearson. I am my third-generation farmer from the Milk River Valley on my mother's side and a third-generation farmer on the Fairfield Bench in the Greenfield Irrigation District where my grandfather homesteaded. I am here opposing House Bill 418. The bill must treat an individual who is married the same as unmarried individuals. Montana cannot discriminate based on marital status. There is no reason this bill should make reference to marital status. As written, the bill discriminates based on marital status. Paragraph 7 of the bill defines qualified recipient. As defined, it treats married couples, which are two individuals, the same as a single individual. There is an acreage limitation of delivering water to set amount of acreage X that would apply to a qualified recipient under this bill, which means two unmarried individuals could get two times the water, whereas two married individuals could only get one times the water. Montana, under MCA 49, precluded the state from discriminating based on marital status. The acreage limitation, as described in the history of it, was based originally when my grandfather homesteaded on the bench as 160 acres. He had 10 children with my grandmother, 6 sons, 4 daughters. At that time, he could hold 160 acres, his wife could hold 160 acres, and all of his minor children could each individually have 160 acres. I think around 1980, when they passed a new reclamation bill, when Ronald Reagan was president, they tried to tighten up what they called the lease loophole. And the way they did an acreage limitation was you could buy the ground, but you just can't get the water for it because the irrigation district is being subsidized. So they were trying to stop the amount of subsidy that they were giving to one large corporation. That was the intent and is the intent of the Bureau's policy today as implemented. When the irrigation district paid off their debt to the Bureau of Reclamation, they were no longer being subsidized and felt a need for there to be an acreage limitation. At that time, there was a law passed to allow all of the landowners of title to vote to be able to implement an acreage limitation, which they did, and as so adopted a lot of the similar language that was in the federal policy, which happened to include a married couple as a husband and a wife under the tax law as one entity, or I don't know if that's the legal term, but as one, not wanting to give more subsidy. And at that time, their words were, we are trying to close the lease loophole attached to it because one corporation would have a huge pyramid and they would one person ultimately receive all the subsidy that the federal government was giving to the irrigation district. With that being implemented, because of that, of us implementing, even though we are paid off, we are not subject to any reclamation rule as far as acreage limitation. The state of Montana gave us the authority to implement it in the House, in the bill, and in so we did. Also attaching similar wording that included the marriage limitation, and as coined by our own district, they called it the marriage penalty. In my childhood, married couples divorced and still lived together in order to increase the size of their farm. Somewhere along the way, the district decided to lease because the federal policy was combined. Leased or owned, they didn't care. It's just how much water you were getting on your farm operation. Our irrigation district doubled the acres years ago, so they're not anywhere near the federal statute, and they lease 960 as well as own 960. This bill, as written, is strictly trying to enforce the marriage penalty by changing the words to try to tie it to that federal statute that we do not need to adhere to. So I am against this because of marriage. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there more opponents?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Holton Pearson. I'm a fourth generation farmer on the Fairfield bench. When I graduated high school, I had the opportunity to attend college down in Rexburg, Idaho. And when I was down there, I found a beautiful little lady that decided to marry me. And I drug her back up to Montana, which her dad wasn't exactly happy about, but he's since forgiven me. My wife and I, we have four children now. Delaney Rose, who is 7, Penelope Joe, who is 5, Kendrick Holton, who is 2 and is currently destroying my house, I'm sure, and my little Colette Echo, who is 8 months old. I've had the great privilege and opportunity to farm almost full-time with a little bit of cattle trucking on the side. I've always got my permits, by the way. Not that I'd ever go around the law. I've had the opportunity to work hard, put in many hours on the farm, many hours through trucking, and in doing so, provide a living where my wife can stay home with our children. She managed to get a bachelor's degree when she was in Rexburg for education. And so far, we haven't been inclined to put her to work, working more than she is, managing the books of the farm, raising the children, bringing me lunches because I'm forgetful and hungry. I love her very much. With this bill that's being proposed, it's attempting to close loopholes where it will prevent my wife from owning acreage and receiving water because she is married to me. But if my wife were to divorce me, do not talk to her about that. She would be able to own 960 acres, and I would be able to own 960 acres. This bill is an attempt to close verbiage that has been tried in the courts and been shown to have some problems in it. I ask that you oppose this so that individuals, whether they are married to the love of their life or not, can have the same acreage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there other opponents? Any online? Don't look like there's any online. I'll try the info witnesses. Are there? I'll try that again. Is there any info witnesses, either here or online? I don't believe so. No.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. I guess committee members, questions. Ms. Senator McCamey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator McCamey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fitzpatrick, Fitzgerald, or wherever. Fitz. Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald. No, I don't think it was. Oh, my goodness. Forgive me. Okay. Addressing on page 2, line 1, the married couples combining instead of being individuals. It sounds kind of archaic to me. It sounds like we're back in the 1700s, and we now the woman is now someone who is. It sounds like one of the married couples, one of the married individuals disappears. It sounds like it only is one person, and I find that archaic.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGamey, I think when I look at this from my perspective, trying to do an objective view on it, you have to look at the last part of that sentence, which says operates as an individual independent farm operation, which means, you know, two separate sets, whether it's machinery, farm sites, whatever. To me, that's kind of the key there is individual independent, whether they're couples or singles.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Mr. Fitzgerald, when I'm thinking of partnership that operates, answer me this. Is the do the individuals in the partnership each have 960 acres?
Mr. Chairman, Senator McCamey, it's my impression and understanding that if there's a name common to both operations, which in a partnership it's as one with two or more members in a partnership, then they could not own another operation with the same name ownership on that. That's how I interpret it, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Thank you. Follow up again, Mr. Chair. Only with a different individual, if I may, please.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Fitzgerald. With Mr. Jewell, please.
Yeah, Mr. Jewell.
Mr. Chair, Senator McCamey.
And it was just kind of a toss-up between you and Mr. Murphy, because I know you both are very knowledgeable and have dealt with this issue for many, many years. In a district, individuals can vote according to the number of acres that they own. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. In a partnership, does the partnership then divide out, and so each individual has a vote?
When assessed acres are owned jointly or within a corporation or within a trust,
partnership,
two people, the number of votes is based on the number of acres that partnership owns. And there has to be a form filled out who is, you know, if it's a 50-50 partnership, then they can do 50-50 of the votes. If it's a 100-acre parcel, each of the two people would get 50 votes for half of the 100 acres. They could fill out a form and says, I want this person to vote for, you know, the corporation or the partnership's votes. It's acres. But keep in mind, I mean, are you talking about a partnership where two people farm together, or are you talking about a legal corporation owned by two people?
Since we're reversing the roles here.
Follow up.
Yes.
I'm asked for clarification.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jewell, what I want to know is, we are defining here, it says, for the purposes of this section, qualified recipient means an individual, married couples, corporation, trust, or partnership that operates as an individual, independent farm or operation. I'm asking whether a partnership is treated, I'll just say it straight up, is a partnership treated differently than a married couple is treated?
It depends how the partnership is defined. If the partnership...
That sounds like yes.
Well, you can have different partnerships. I mean, who owns the land? The question is, it gets to be the district, how they administer the law. Who owns the land? Does the corporation own the land? Or does a legal partnership own the land? Or is it just two people farming together?
Follow up.
Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. You're being so indulgent. Mr. Jewell, and Mr. Chair, thank you again for your indulgence. If a partnership has two individuals that have the same name, are they treated the same as a married couple?
If they farm as an independent operation, they are part of that independent operation. Are they filing their IRS statements independent of each other? Then they're basically just farming together, but they are treated separately. If they are filing as a operation or in an operation, and the IRS recognizes it as one operation, and the Farm Service Administration recognizes it as one farm operation, then it doesn't matter how many people are, it's one operation. And who owns the land? Does the corporation own the land? Do individuals own the land? How is that made up? So it's not an easy answer, because there's a lot of different things you could do. And, you know, again, the law is not, this is meant to clarify that you're not looking at people, individuals. You're looking at operations. An operation can own 960 acres. You've heard that there's a marriage penalty. Well, what actually is being sought is a marriage benefit. Somebody wants to have more assessed land just because they're married. Even though they farm together, they own the land together, they file a single IRS statement, they report to the Farm Services Administration as a single entity, they are a single operation.
Follow-up, I'm sorry.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Jewell. I still didn't get an answer about married couples being treated the same as a partnership. So my ask is, tell me how a married couple is different than a partnership, even though they are farming together. It's one entity. And you said that they can file separate IRS file with the IRS separately, and somehow that makes a difference. So I'm thinking to myself, as a married person, why wouldn't I file separately and accommodate, as a married couple, the same process that the partnership is accommodating? Because it's sounding like a partnership should be like a marriage, like a married couple.
That's a question? Or
it is a question.
Okay.
So tell me how it's different. Tell me how it's different. It's the question.
Okay. Chairman and Senator McCamey, again, if two people are farming together and they are farming as one operation, then they're limited to the 960. It doesn't matter if it's a man and a wife, a brother and a sister, a Republican and a Democrat. If they're farming together as a legal entity, as a single farm operation, recognized as a separate business, then they are basically an operation limited to 960. And it wouldn't matter if it was a corporation with one person or 100 people. If that corporation owns the land, and that corporation is the business, then that corporation is limited to the 960.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jewell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for the person, but do you want to go on to somebody else?
Is anybody else want to jump in here right now, or shall I leave it in Senator McCamey's? Go ahead.
Okay. If I may, thank you very much, Mr. Jewell, I'd like to visit with sure. Mr. Murphy, please.
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McCamey.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Murphy, good to see you again, and I know you're very knowledgeable, as is Mr. Jewell, and can help us sort this out. I am wondering why we cannot have married couples have individual ownership of water.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McCamey, individual married couples can. They could be operating under the terms of this statute, could be operating as two totally separate operations, even though they're married. They may be filing separate tax returns. They may be using separate operational facilities. They may be using different equipment, not utilizing the same equipment, and so forth. So they're totally independent, total separate operations, whether they're married or not. And I guess from my perspective, I've always looked at the married couple as being a partnership. I've always looked at it that way. And again, under a partnership, the same provisions would apply, that if you are operating as one individual within a partnership, whether it be three, four, or five partners, if they're all operating with the same equipment, still filing the same, maybe it's an LLC, filing under the same provisions of that LLC, then it would potentially be and would be subject to the limitation of the 960 acres.
Okay, just one quick follow-up with you.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Murphy, was wondering if, just for clarification, married couples, corporations, trusts, partnerships are all 960 acres.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McCamey, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bartel.
Mr. Vice Chair, if you in committee would maybe have a little indulgence, because this is as clear as mud to this guy. But Mr. Jewell, please, question for Mr. Jewell, please, if I could, Vice Chair.
Vice Chair, Senator Bartel.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So basically you're saying that there's up on the Fairfield area that you're allowed 960 acres of water rights or irrigated water, land that you can use out of the system per corporation, per family, per partnership. Is that what it is?
Chair Gillespie, Senator Bartel, yes, it's per operation. It's 960 acres owned and 960 acres leased. So potentially individual operation could farm 920 acres of irrigated land. They would be only owning 960. And their voting power would be limited to the 960, which they own. If they lease land, they could get an arrangement from the person they lease the land from to vote those acres accordingly, or the owner could retain that privilege as the owner of those assessed acres.
Follow up? So,
Vice Chair.
Mr. Jewell, is it unlimited amount that I could go up there and lease the acreage?
Mr.
As long as I own 960 acres, or do I have to, can I go lease 5,000 acres of it?
Vice Chair, Senator Bartel, you could lease up to 960 as well if you are an individual farm operation. And those rules that we're discussing are available for each district. I mean, MC 857-1837 provides the foundation for acreage limitation. It also provides the ability for the irrigation districts to model those based on their membership. GID represents over 750 owners of land. Some are 1 acre, some are 960 plus acres.
Okay.
And other than state law, our board policies can be changed if a producer wants to go to his membership and gather 60% of the owners and 60% of the land in question and petition, well, with acquiring those two triggers, he basically, or she basically, or the corporation basically gets the, you know, gets their wish because they have basically the representation of the membership. So the request that individual producers want to make changes to the individual districts board policies are available to those people if they seek that from their membership.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Jewell, maybe, well, or are there anybody else want to jump in here at this point? Anybody else? Maybe Mr. Jewell would, yeah, can you come to the podium again? I'm kind of like Senator Bartell. I'm still, this is whirling around in my head. But I'm assuming, you know, there's a number of colonies in that area. So I would assume that they would be confined to the same 960 acres, even though maybe they have 100 people or 120 people on a colony. They would probably be confined to that same 960 base acres. Is that
right? That is correct. As Vice Chair Gillespie, as a entity, a legal entity, and in that case, I believe the colonies are recognized as corporations. Yeah. And they would basically represent an individual farm operation. And as Mr. Murphy said, a husband and wife, if they were to farm independently and file independent with the IRS and the Farm Service Administrations, they could each own 960. But if they co-own the land and they file as you know, one corporation or one entity together, then that's the entity that's looked at as the 960. You can't look at the individuals in that situation. And an interesting thing is, let's say that a man and a wife each own 960 and came together in marriage. Acreage limitations does not preclude marriage. I've had this discussion with our board. It's never been challenged in 17 Western states by reclamation and anywhere else that I can find, but our board has recognized the fact that that possibility could happen. Two widows could come together and marry and farm together. And I know, and these are the kinds of things that each irrigation district would wrestle with, how they structure their board policies to satisfy 85-7-1837. And with respect to our board, although we haven't put it into our board policies, our board has recognized the fact that this could be happen. We don't want to, you know, it's not meant to discourage marriage. I don't know what's happened in the past, but that was before my tenure. But so let's say two individuals get married, come together, and they by definition have over 960. The board can allow them to stay at what they come together as, but let's just say they both came in with 500, so they're at 1,000. The board would say, that's fine, you're grandfathered in, you're married, congratulations, but you would not be able to buy more land because now as one individual operation, you'll be capped. And even though you're grandfathered at a new cap, 1,000, you can't necessarily continue to go above that. If they sold some land off, that cap would then drop again as a single operation. One person, 10 people, doesn't matter. That if that cap dropped below 960, then that would be the ceiling then. But 85-7 doesn't discriminate on a marital basis.
Yes. Senator O'Brien.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for, are you both Mr. Pearson?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Pearson. I won't say the elder. the first Mr. Pearson. So help me understand, based on your testimony, which might conflict with what we've heard before, and this focus on I'm looking at page 2, line 1, the married couple term. So if my husband and I want to go into farming, and is there something that now prohibits us from each owning 960 acres of land to farm, Mr. Chair?
So the way that works is you're describing my story. So I started farming in 2004. I got married to my wife, who was a widow. We started farming together, running a farm operation, have had some success, been able to get real estate put together up to the 960. Through my childhood, I had heard of my neighbors who divorced, and I always thought that was crazy that they did that to get more land. And then when I go to the board and ask them if I can, Hillary and I can farm and own more than 960, they say, no, you can only farm 960. When I say, if we're two separate, they like to try the term farm operation is very vague. For instance, under what you've heard so far is if they two people own land together. Well, I own land with my brother jointly. The way our irrigation district does that is if we own 200 acres together, I'm allocated 100 acres, so is he. Even though we're titled, we're not a farm operation. Now, I do farm with two of my brothers and my nephew who is here today. We each own and run our own operating budgets. We each file with the Farm Service Agency separately, but we show up and help each other because we're a family. That is what's disturbing about this to me, is it is the nature of the family that is under attack by this. A husband and a wife, even in the Farm Service Office, can set up and file differently on taxes so that they can each qualify as two, like, operations. I don't know if that's the correct term, and get subsidy from the federal government. They changed that a few years ago. Now, if I do that, according to the irrigation district that I sit in now, they strictly say a married couple is considered one individual. Therefore, I can only own 480, and my wife can only 480. Even if I leased her ground that's in her name, her limit is tied to mine no matter what we do. It's 960 acres, no matter if we split up, no matter if she goes south and I go north. Due to the fact that we are married, our rights are cut in half. I can only vote, in theory, on up to 480 if we each own it. She can only vote on her 480, or we can assign it to each other. But if we get divorced, that all goes away. And at that point, I can own 960 as an individual. And that's the way our state law is written now, that it's possible to do that. That then she, as an individual, can also own 960 acres. So it is very important to clarify the rights that are taken away by the status of married, which Montana's anti-discrimination bill says any government agency cannot deny the services given based on marital status. And due to the fact that I am a married man and my wife is married to me, and we each own real estate jointly, and we do not separate our farm out, but we could, but it wouldn't help us with our irrigation district. We each have half the rights, but if we divorced, they double.
Follow up.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pearson, Online, I know you don't have the bill. It doesn't look like you have the bill in front of you, but line one on page two says, for the purposes of this section, qualified recipient means an individual, comma, married couple, comma, corporation, trust, or partnership that operates as an individual independent farm operation. I'm just wondering if an amendment were to be drafted that eliminated that married couple verbiage in line one of page two, if that would solve the problem from your perspective, might have a different conversation with other folks as well. Mr. Chair? Mr. Pearson?
So the terminology of qualified recipient is an attempt to tie to the definition that was in federal reclamation law, where they put a married couple together as one entity to receive a subsidy. As far as how it applies to this bill or what it is changing, it is not changing the protection, as Erling testified to. We have the right to petition our landowners. I was told to do that because I have brought this before our board. My problem is how do I petition the landowners to get rid of the discrimination policy? It's either legal or it's not. And meanwhile, this whole purpose of why this is here today, I'm sure, is due to the fact that I have filed a complaint with the Montana Human Rights Bureau, due to the fact that we're married. And for no other reason, we've lost our voting right and our right to the water. And they're saying it's for the sake of the family farm. And they say they're worried about the control that may come by entities or large groups. My grandfather had six sons. Did the federal government have them homestead so that the rest of the sons could leave and maybe not ever talk to each other again, be separate farm operations? I get the privilege to work with two of my brothers and a nephew, and we are independently responsible for our own finances. I love every day I get to go to work, but because my wife stays home and she is great at doing the books and all of the efforts, we are like second-class citizens because of our marital status. And this bill is trying to shore up and put leverage to that point, which violates Montana state law as written now. When you go into the discrimination code, we are discriminating as a district against married people only because of their marital status.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Martel.
Question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartel.
Representative, so just after we heard this last testimony, did this bill go through legal review?
As far as I know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bartel, went through the process.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Not, I guess, would the sponsor like to close?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would, like I say, this is just a clarification of a definition here to make sure that the true intent of the irrigation district is carried out. And I can't address any of the other issues because I'm not a lawyer. So with that, I would encourage a do pass on House Bill 418, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I guess you have another one, do you?
No.
Mr. Chair, I think that got postponed, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you.
Okay, let you off the hook then. Is there any other questions, comments? At this point, we'll close the hearing. There, take
over. Committee, we have a couple bills on Thursday. Appreciate your indulgence. And anything needs to come from the committee before the committee? Pardon?
I'm wondering on 418 if we
Sure. I can talk to legal. Yep.
All right. Let it be known that we're, this committee is requesting a legal review on House Bill 418.2. Okay. I didn't hear the bills. Any bills you want to do EA on? You wait till Thursday? I'd prefer to wait till Thursday so I could talk to you. But okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Tuesday.
Oh, Tuesday, yeah. Hi, Mom. Meeting's closed.